at the right moment. The fire...
Oh, no, you don't, Jilly said. The fire happened, and it's horrible. But Gran and I are okay, and we'll get over it, because even treasured mementos are only things, not people. Now, you started to say something, and from the look on Harrison's face, it's something you've already told him, so spill it.
We're friends, Raoul added, in his deep, gentle voice. We've been friends a long time, the four of us, Jilly and me, Harrison and Sari. Then Jilly brought you to the movies. She said you'd fit, and she was right. But being a friend doesn't mean you have to tell us what you're not ready to tell.
Raoul, Jilly said indignantly.
Oh, for heaven's sake, I said, half laughing. I do want to tell you, but it's so weird.
Weird is okay, Raoul said.
And right then, the waiter appeared. Hearing these words, he looked uncharacteristically startled.
Desserts, he asked, assuming his bland expression.
I have the feeling I might need a serious dessert for this, Jilly said decisively. I'll have the chocolate mousse. We all laughed, and the tightness of the last few minutes evaporated, carrying my nervousness with it. After all, Harrison had believed me, and what would happen if Jilly and Raoul didn't? I wouldn't fall down dead.
26.
How do you mean extended? Raoul asked. Well, smell, for example. I can smell that you were squeezing oranges before you came here, and Jilly, you washed your hands in rose soap. But before that you were polishing silver. This seemed so unlikely that I looked to her for confirmation. Gran wanted to polish a locket, she began. Then she stopped, looking astonished. Harrison, I went on, you were pouring alcohol sometime today, and maybe you spilled it. Harrison's face seemed to whiten, and I wondered a little at that, but my story had its own momentum, and it carried me on. I can smell those things just by being close enough. I can also smell what I've come to think of as your essence. That's something I smell every time I see you, but again, I have to be reasonably close, and I have to be looking at you. I can also smell things you're feeling, though I often don't know what the smell represents. My sense of smell is the strongest of my senses, but I can also hear better. Those waiters over by the door are talking about a man who paid with a stolen credit card last night, and in the foyer behind them, two women are arguing.
Jesus, Harrison said explosively.
You said you could smell and hear better than normal, but I didn't realize.
What about taste? Jilly asked, her eyes wide. I laughed. I almost got high on risotto the first time I tried it. I don't think about what I'm eating now if I can help it, but sometimes I suck a mint to distract myself from getting locked into focusing too hard on something. That was the first way I had of protecting myself.
Tell me more about this number screen you say you've constructed to protect yourself when you're talking to people, Raoul prompted.
It's made up of memorized bits of easier and more difficult calculations fit together like a quilt, and I can summon it up just by imagining it. I use the lighter or denser sections to screen, depending on how much protection I need. I'm using a thick part right now because you're all looking at me. If I didn't, the pressure of your attention would hurt me. It's best if I have the screen up before someone focuses their attention on me.
How did you figure out numbers would protect you? Raoul wanted to know.
It was after a maths class at school. I'd been doing some difficult calculations which left a sort of web in my mind. I noticed that when anyone started paying attention to me, the web trapped most of the force of their input. I tried to recreate what had happened, first by counting, then by reciting various times tables. I found that the more complex the calculation, the stronger the blocking effect. But I couldn't start doing difficult calculations any time I was under pressure. So that's when I had the idea of memorizing bits and making a screen that way.
Like a memory cathedral, Raoul said admiringly. But you said you had other methods of protecting yourself.
I nodded. Thinking of my baby brother's face can block pretty much all input, but it's so strong that I only use it in an emergency. The other major protection is clamping my senses to reduce them to normal levels, but it's pretty tiring.
Tell them about touch, Harrison said eagerly.
If I make physical contact with someone, I mean skin-to-skin contact, I seem to be able to feel what that person is feeling.
but it's pretty overwhelming, and I haven't found a way to protect myself from it. The only time physical contact doesn't hurt is when the person I'm touching is thinking about me or thinking the same thing as me. The worst is when I touch someone and see things, just flashes of vision, but it's like the images crash into me.
Visions? Raoul echoed softly.
I never know if what I see is real or something the person I'm touching has dreamed up.
How do our essences smell? Jilly asked suddenly.
I smiled. Raoul smells of olive oil, lemon, and some sort of polish. You smell of the sea and the beach and the wind, and Harrison smells of cedar, pine needles, and lavender, and right now rain on hot earth.
Jilly looked surprised and gratified, then bemused. But what does it mean that I smell of the sea?
I'm not sure it means anything more than that you have brown hair. The transient smells are more revealing when I can figure out what they mean. When you're worried, for instance, I smell seaweed, and when you're happy, I smell fairy floss. My Da smells of ammonia when he's worried.
Worry smells different on different people, Raoul marveled.
Can you smell your own essence? Harrison asked.
I shook my head and was about to tell them I couldn't smell Aaron Race's either when Jilly gave a gasping cry.
Harlan, she said, that's why you don't like him getting interested in you, isn't it? It's to do with how he smells.
I nodded and had to fight a powerful reluctance to say, he smells really horrible, worse than anything I've ever smelled, even worse than Dr. Austin.
Dr. Austin? You don't mean the same Dr. Austin who treats Sari?
Raoul's voice was sharp.
I repeated what I had told Harrison, including that Sari didn't smell bad, despite her certainty that she was infected with wrongness. Then I nodded to Harrison, and he took over and told them succinctly that we believed I was smelling some sort of spiritual sickness.
Raoul's expression darkened.
If you're right about the terrible smell, meaning Dr. Austin has the same sickness as Sari, it could be that, unlike him, she doesn't smell because she won't allow her sickness to become active.
I had the same thought, Harrison said. Then he gave me a worried look.
If we're right, this guy at your school who smells like Dr. Austin must be contagious.
He may be, Raoul cautioned. Remember, this is all speculation. We don't know that the sickness smells only when it's active. We don't even know if this guy is aware he's infected.
For that matter, Dr. Austin might not know it either, because if they knew it, they would resist it as Sari does.
But how would they infect people without knowing they're doing it? Jilly asked.
Raoul shrugged. Infecting someone else could be no more than a matter of making physical contact, though I tend to think it has to be more complicated, otherwise every second person would be infected. The point is that there are a lot of sicknesses where the person who is the carrier need not be aware they're infected or infectious. If you think about it, the sicknesses are served by the ignorance of their hosts, and so it may be that this sickness is driving its victims to seek situations where infection can occur.
You're making it sound as if this sickness is alive, Jilly said, looking revolted.
I would call it a biological imperative, Raoul said. It might also be that the sickness is aware of people who are infected. That could explain why Dr. Austin is trying to drug Sari. Remember how she feels that drugs lower her resistance to the sickness?
You think the sickness in Dr. Austin is trying to help the sickness in Sari to break its host's will?
Harrison asked dubiously.
It sounds radical, but this thing is so far outside normal that I think we have to consider it. And it would explain why Dr. Austin was trying to drug Alison as well. He, or the sickness in him, needed her will to be low and weak because it wanted to infect her.
He shot me a look.
I assume you'd know if you were infected.
His suggestion that Dr. Austin had been trying to infect me made me feel very strange. I can't smell my own essence, but I think I wouldn't be so scared of Harlan or so revolted by how he and Dr. Austin smell if I were.
That makes sense, Raoul said. Jilly said this Harlan was showing an interest in you. When did that start?
I saw at once what he was going to say. I'd been back at school 2 weeks after the coma, before he asked me out,
But now he's asking me out all the time and asking questions about me and my family and calling me. I stopped, my skin crawling at the thought that all of Harlan's determined pursuit might be nothing more than the prompting of some malevolent virus trying to find a way to infect me. I told them about running away like a terrified deer after seeing Harlan and not feeling any need to do so the next time I saw him. That would fit with the sickness having cycles, where it's stronger or weaker, Harrison said to Raoul. It might even be that when Alison returned to school, it was in a weak phase, so it couldn't react. Another possibility is that the sickness might need its host to be close, for it to become aware of your extended senses, Raoul pointed out. And maybe the reason your danger sense is warning you not to show him how you feel is because that would alert the sickness to your awareness of it. Suddenly, Jilly gasped and turned to me. Alison, with the fire and everything, I forgot to tell you. I saw Harlan on Saturday morning. He was livid because you'd stood him up. Of course, I didn't know what had happened with Sari. I just said I was going to see you that afternoon. He gave me this killing look and said he didn't suppose I'd be stood up. I felt a strange chill at her words, and maybe I looked scared, because Harrison said gruffly, "That cannot be that easy to infect you, because he'd have done it already if he only had to touch you. All you have to do is avoid being alone with him." "I can't keep evading," I said, feeling a stab of despair. "It feels dangerous." Jilly said, "Maybe the reason Alison feels scared is because some bit of her feels that the sickness could provoke Harlan to do something about her, if it saw her as an enemy." There was a deep silence between us. Then Raoul shook his head. "I'd say the sickness would have a lot of trouble directing anyone to do actual physical harm, unless it was already in the host's nature. And even then there would have to be circumstances that would allow the host to think the idea of causing harm was their own idea, like a doctor who had a tendency to overprescribe being prompted to drug a patient." At that moment, the waiter came over to say that the restaurant was closing. I looked at my watch and was astounded to see how late it was. I asked if there was a phone I could use to call Da, but Raoul offered his mobile. Jilly laughed at the look on my face, took the phone out of my hand, and tapped my number in. "It's me," I said gingerly, when Da answered, "Sorry it's so late. We've just finished rehearsing, and I'm sure it helped Jilly to have a good talk after the shock of the fire," Da said. I felt guilty on Jilly's behalf then, because we hadn't talked about the fire for hours. We all got up and pulled on our coats, and I noticed the waiters were standing in a group by the bar looking bored and talking in low voices. "I should have said I'd take you home to save your father the trip," Raoul said apologetically as we walked down the ramp with him to the foyer. "It's fine. Dow was up rehearsing anyway. I think he's going to do another gig for Aaron Race." "I thought he wanted your Dow alone," Jilly said. "He does, but Da is working on some new songs with Losing the Rope." "How did he smell?" Harrison asked suddenly. "Aaron Race." I shrugged. "He didn't smell of anything." I wanted to say something about how he and Da affected the air around them, but it was too complicated and too late. I also hadn't told them about Cole and Mrs. Barker either, but I could tell them all that on the weekend.
"I'll have a look at his website anyway," Raoul promised. "But in the meantime, you do your best to stay away from Harlan until we can think how to handle him."
Comforted by how easily and naturally he used the word "we," I turned to Jilly. "Listen, I feel bad that most of the night has been spent talking about me when we were supposed to..."
"Take my mind off the fire?" Jilly asked.
"I think you could say you were successful." She grinned and moved closer to give me a hug. Then she stopped. "Is it bad if I hug you?" I laughed, relieved at her simple directness. "It's fine." "Good," Jilly declared, and hugged me hard. "You'd better go up to your gran," I told her. "And you two go too," I told Raoul and Harrison. "I'll just wait in here for Da."
"No way," they said, in perfect unison, and after a startled instant of silence, we all laughed.
"All for one and one for all," Jilly added. One of the waiters came out and told Jilly she'd forgotten to sign for the meal, and then Raoul wanted to leave a tip, and by the time that had been sorted out, There was a flash of headlights, and Dar's old van swept into the curving entrance to the hotel. I introduced him to Raoul. Then he turned to Jilly and told her how sorry he was to hear what had happened to her house.
"Can we give you two a lift?"
he asked Raoul and Harrison. But Raoul said he had his own car. Then we all said goodbye to Jilly and went out, the three guys talking about Raoul's modified car. I glanced back and saw Jilly standing alone in the ornate entrance to that big, expensive, impersonal hotel, and felt infinitely glad that I was about to go home in Dar's old rattletrap to our big, noisy, disorganized house, full of a mother and brothers and sisters and creativity and love, even if we had too little money. Wednesday dawned warm but dark, the sky full of scabby brown clouds and the wind blowing hard in several directions at once. It was the kind of day that makes dogs howl and horses twitch their ears and break into sudden skittish bursts of speed. At breakfast, Dar mentioned that he had agreed to the new gig with the other band. He sounded cheerful, but his ammonia smell was strong. Aaron Race, I thought grimly, and I suddenly had a clear memory of him and the announcer at the Urban Dingo gig, talking to the guy in green shoes, while Gary Solomon stood in the background, watching them intently. I thought about the journalist on the way to school, wondering if he had been doing a story about Aaron Race. But by the time the bus pulled up, I couldn't think of anything other than having to face Harlan again. Reasoning that it would be better to go on avoiding Harlan than refusing him, I managed to skulk in unlikely places between classes all morning. Jilly was supposed to come to school in the afternoon, but when lunchtime came and went without her arriving, I decided to sneak out of the school and call just to make sure everything was all right. Standing there, hearing the phone ring, I experienced a discomforting sense of déjà vu, but Jilly soon came on to tell me that she'd intended to come to school that morning and was even in her uniform, only the police had phoned to say they wanted to speak to her grandmother again. "They're with her now," she said unhappily. "I wish they hadn't come. Gran was so happy about Raoul's ideas of cyber-tourism. She wanted to go to Venice first, because that's where she and Grandad went for their honeymoon. But after the police rang, she got all quiet and sad again. I better go back. I don't want to leave her to face them alone." I rang off and went back to school, wishing for the 100th time that the day was over. Last period seemed to take forever. Maybe it was that feeling of frustration that gave me the idea of going to the newspaper office and trying to talk to Gary Solomon. I went out of the school the back way, just in case Harlan was lurking, but I hadn't gone far before it started to rain. It was so heavy that I sprinted back to the main road, where I knew there would be a bus shelter. There was a woman standing in it already, and we exchanged rueful smiles, then stood together in silence, peering glumly out at the rain. When I tired of watching the street, I turned my attention to the ads on the walls of the shelter. They were heavily defaced, and I grimaced at a Nazi swastika wound about with snakes. You'd think no one would ever want to use that symbol again, given what it had been associated with, the woman said. Isn't it some sort of eternal energy sign when it's drawn that way round? I asked, when we had looked at it a bit longer. A teacher had once explained the difference between the two symbols. The woman studied it. You're right, but the snakes don't seem to go with eternal energy, so maybe the gang actually meant to draw the Nazi cross. Gang? It's the emblem of a skinhead gang over in Shaletown, the woman said. I guess they're widening their territory. She shook her head, and just then the bus loomed up.
27.
Inside the foyer of the newspaper office, there was a line of people waiting to book advertisements and a desk where you could order photos from the paper. Two people were standing here having an argument over dates, while the young man behind the counter watched them. There was a door beside the photo desk marked Advertising Manager, and a security door marked Editorial, through which I saw the flight of stairs we had climbed to enter the inner sanctum of the paper the day Mrs. Barker had brought us. I went over to the receptionist and asked if I could speak to Gary Solomon.
Is he expecting you?
I have some important information for him, I said, trying to look older than I was. The receptionist just nodded with supreme indifference, pressed some keys on her computer console,
and then talked into the mouthpiece looping out of the earphones she was wearing. She wore the earphones slightly askew, so that she could hear out of one ear, and now she angled her head towards me. "Name?" "Alison White Star," I said. She repeated the name, then listened to her earphones. I extended my hearing and heard a female voice answer. The receptionist asked for Gary Solomon, and then there was a man's voice asking who wanted him. The receptionist repeated my name, and I heard him say it with a note of surprise and ask if she was sure. The receptionist said I seemed to be sure of my identity, and he laughed and told her that he'd come right down. 5 minutes later, he emerged from the security door. His eyes skated right over me, so I stepped closer and was reassured to discover that Gary Solomon smelled a lot like a walk through a forest in autumn. I said, "I'm Alison. My class came here and you gave us a talk on newspapers."
"Ah," his eyes widened in sudden comprehension. "You were with the class from hell."
I laughed. "Not all of us came from hell, just a couple of the boys. The rest of us came from right here on Earth." He smiled slightly.
"Fair enough. Well, Alison, what can I do for you?"
"You went to see Urban Dingo in concert at the Dome."
"I didn't," he began.
"I saw you there."
"Yes, and I saw you," he said patiently. "I didn't recognize you at first because you weren't wearing a uniform then. I guess you went to see your brother."
"My father is McCall White Star," I said. "But why did you say you weren't at the gig?"
"I was about to say, I didn't go to see Urban Dingo, or your father's band for that matter. That was pretty sensational. I was there because I was working."
"On what?"
His face closed up. "It's my job to ask the questions," he said coolly.
"So no one else should?" I asked, annoyed. A faint impatience flowed into his features.
"What was your question?"
I swallowed. "Were you at the concert because you were investigating Aaron Race?" His expression hardly changed, but a sharp, pickled onion smell infused the autumn wood fragrance.
"Let's go get a coffee," he suggested.
His tone implied he was bored, but his sense told me he wanted to get me away from other people. We went out of the office and into a nearby arcade, passing three coffee places, before he led me into a rather dingy Italian restaurant beside an old-fashioned barbershop. The door was open, but the lights were off inside, and the big sleepy-looking Rasta man who came out at the sound of our entrance looked as if he'd just crawled out of a rave recovery. He gave the journalist a wave and headed for the coffee machine.
"What will the lady have, solo man?" he called.
"Coffee. Espresso," I said, because I felt I needed to counterbalance the uniform. Gary Solomon shouted the order, then turned back to give me a speculative look.
"So, what makes you ask about Aaron Race?"
"Aaron Race set up the gig with Urban Dingo because he heard a song Dar wrote," I said. "Ever since the concert he's been coming around and offering Dar jobs, only the jobs are not with Losing the Rope. First they were solo, and now they're with some other band whose lead singer just happened to get sick." I stopped, because the Rasta man brought the drinks, the silver cuffs on his dreadlocks clinking as he set two mugs down, then shuffled away.
"So, let me get this straight," Gary Solomon said, when he'd gone. "You're bothered because a rich, powerful businessman is showing an interest in your dad. Isn't that a good thing?"
His voice was slightly mocking, and suddenly I was furious that he was using his face and voice to lie. "I don't think it's a good thing, and what's more, I don't think you think so either," I said very coolly.
"You figure this out from an expression on my face at a gig."
A sharp citrus smell that I guessed might represent curiosity reminded me to be careful, because this guy made a living out of finding out people's secrets. "Why were you watching Aaron Race?" I asked mildly, playing his game.
"I could have been looking at the other guys with him," Gary Solomon said.
"You could," I agreed. He suddenly grinned, looking nicer.
"What exactly is it that you want to know?"
"I don't like Aaron Race, and I want to know what he does. He's not an agent or a promoter. He says so himself. His website is weird because it doesn't tell you anything."
"I know about the website."
He sipped at his coffee, though my hands around my own cup told me it was scalding hot. Then his sense shifted, and I could distinctly smell newsprint.
"I went to the concert because I wanted to get a look at him, without his knowing it. I had heard
a few things that made me wonder about him, but it turned out to be nothing. He was watching me over the rim of his cup.
"I don't believe you," I said flatly. "I don't see why you can't tell me what you know. It's not like I'm going to steal your story."
He sat back in his chair and laughed.
"I should confide my love life to you while I'm at it, and maybe my tax file number."
His snide tone infuriated me.
"Well, maybe I'll just ask Aaron Race why a journalist is taking an interest in him."
I hadn't meant it as a threat, so much as an angry comeback, but the blood rushed to his face, and for the first time, his expression matched the sense he was giving out.
"If you talk to Race about me, it might be a lot more than a news story that got hurt, girl. Your father's not the only person involved here."
I felt ashamed, but also triumphant, because I'd finally got him to say something straight out. I said,
"I'm just worried about my da. I wouldn't tell anyone anything you told me, not even him."
A nerve beat at the journalist's temple.
"Are you a girl of your word, Alison Whitestar?"
he asked at last.
"I am," I said gravely. "Then I will give you this. Aaron Race is bad news to artists. He ruins their lives or their careers, or he turns them into something that's the opposite of everything they cared about before they met him. I'd like to know why, and that's why I'm digging. So far, I haven't found out anything that makes sense, but I have learned that bad things happen to people who poke their noses into Aaron Race's business. Very bad things."
I felt the blood draining from my face. I didn't know what I expected, but it wasn't this.
"My da..." "Look," Gary Solomon interrupted forcefully. "If your dad comes into the paper demanding to know what I'm on about, I'll deny this conversation, and my friend behind the counter there will swear on a stack of Bibles that you came in here with a lot of crazy talk and he threw you out. End of story."
"I said I wouldn't say anything," I said quietly. He calmed down.
"I'm sorry to get so heavy, but this is a heavy guy, and he has ears in places you wouldn't imagine. Don't tell anyone about this talk, and if you've got any sense, forget about Aaron Race. Your dad looked like a pretty bright guy, and he can probably take care of himself a lot better than you could."
He got up.
"Go home, Alison Whitestar."
He reached in his pocket to take out a $10 note and tossed it on the table. I stood up too. "Thank you for talking to me." He opened his mouth as if he wanted to say something else, then he shook his head and left. I was still standing there staring after him when the Rasta man glided over and scooped up the $10 note. I don't know what he saw in my face, but he said,
"Hey, gal, don't look so down. Solomon is a good guy. If he hunt in a story, he gonna get that story, and he gonna protect his sources. He infamous for it, eh?"
I looked at him and let the warm chocolate smell of his kindness soothe me. "Thanks," I said. I walked back to the library, thinking about what the journalist had not said, as much as the things he had. There was still some time before the bus, so I went into the library, determined to open every one of the list of entries about Aaron Race that I'd pulled up the other day, but all of the computer consoles were booked by what looked like a busload of Japanese tourists emailing home. Since I was in an investigative frame of mind, I went to the older phone books to see if I could find a listing for a private school in Shale Town that had been closed down. It took me no time to find out that there had been a private boys' academy in Carmine Street, Shale Town. I wrote down the address, feeling excited. Then I went back to check the computer terminals, but the consoles were all still in use. I gave up and went outside. There were still 5 minutes to go before the bus, so I nipped round to the phones and called Harrison. It wasn't until the number was ringing I remembered I'd promised not to say anything about the conversation with Gary Solomon. I was about to hang up when a man answered the phone, sounding drunk. Before I could do more than say my name, he swore and hung up. I stared at the phone, thinking I must have rung a wrong number. That night when I slept, I dreamed again that I was a wolf, endlessly hunting something that smelled of wrongness. I woke feeling tired and out of sorts, wondering why I kept dreaming about the ruined city that was no city I could recognize, and about myself being a wolf. I had never had recurring dreams before, and the only thing I could think was that the dream was my subconscious, trying to deal with the input from my extended senses, in particular, from my sense of smell. When I got downstairs the next morning, Dow was dressed to go out,
and checking his duffel bag. "What's happening?" I asked.
"Got a gig in Remington," Das said.
"Remington?"
"I told you about it," Das said distractedly, easing the zip past the worn bit that always caught. "The gig with the other band."
"It's in a sports arena called Sarkat Stadium. Ricky and I saw a concert there last year," Miranda chipped in, and Dad nodded cheerfully. There was no sign of the doubts he had shown on the stairs a few days before, and given the things Gary Solomon had told me, this did the opposite of reassuring me.
"What is it?"
Dad asked, catching the look on my face. "I just don't much like Aaron Race," I said lamely. I wanted to tell him to cancel the gig, but even if I had broken my promise and told Dad what Gary Solomon had said, it wasn't concrete enough to make him break a commitment.
"He's not our kind of person," Das said. "That doesn't make him a bad person. He's doing me a favor, funneling work my way, right when we need it for your mum's show."
He zipped his bag fully and went upstairs to say goodbye to Mum and Luke, calling back that whoever was ready in 10 minutes could get a lift to school. I didn't feel much like rushing, but I wanted to find out more about the gig, so I grabbed a banana for breakfast, stuffed the lunch I'd made the night before in my bag, and ran upstairs. "I'm coming," I called through a mouthful of toothpaste as I saw Da heading downstairs carrying Luke.
"Chop, chop," he said.
By the time I got to the kitchen, Jesse was in his dressing gown, feeding mushed-up wheat bakes to Luke, and Da and the others were gone.
"They're waiting in the car," Jesse said.
The phone rang and I snatched it up.
"Yes?"
"Yes to you too," Harrison said. He sounded terse. "Harrison, hang on," I told him, and ran out to tell Da to go without me.
"Right, see you in a couple of days," Da said.
I ran inside and grabbed up the receiver, registering what Da had said with a sinking heart. "Sorry, Harrison, what is it?"
"Did you call my number last night?"
He sounded tired as well as tense. "Well, I did, but I thought I must have got the wrong number. There was a man..." I trailed off, remembering that the man had seemed to be drunk. Remembering also that I had changed my mind about calling.
"It was my father," Harrison said brusquely.
There was a crash in the background.
"Look, I have to go, Allison," he said hastily, and hung up.
I was more than glad to see Jilly waiting for me at the gate when the bus pulled up. She hooked her arm protectively through mine as we came into the school, enveloping me in the lovely freshness of her sea scent. I knew she was there, waiting, in case Harlan came looking for me again, but he was nowhere in sight. The bell rang as we were coming through the gate, so we had to run to the lockers and then to our homeroom. First periods were history and a timed essay, then maths and a quiz, so we didn't get to talk properly until lunchtime. I had booked the console in the computer room for the first half hour, the maximum time slot, and Jilly agreed to come with me, though she said I ought to leave the cyberspying to Raoul. I said I just wanted to look at some articles about Aaron Race. I asked how the interview with the police had gone. Jilly shrugged and said it had seemed to her to be nothing more than a repeat of the last interview. By then, we had reached the computer room, and I was pleased to find it free, even though my time had yet to start. There was a big note warning students about what they had downloaded, because a virus had recently infected the system, corrupting much of the school's network of computers. Once I was installed at the console, I did what I had done the first time and tapped Aaron Race's name into the search engine. The same list of entries as before came up, but this time I tapped on the first. It turned out to be the luridly over-decorated website of a gossip magazine famous for its bitchiness, as well as for its raunchy photos. Of course, the school system blocked the download, so I backtracked and tapped the second item on the list. Another magazine website came up, but this one was a who's who type monthly magazine with photos and stories of people with a pedigree. There were more photos of people on horses than standing on their own 2 feet, which was probably why I could open the page. The mention of Race came in an article on the first page, which talked about him being at a charity ball for hunger relief with his wife Dieter. With them, the article said, was the singer Angel Blue, who'd recently won a major music industry award. "Angel Blue," I said to Jilly, who shrugged her ignorance, but made a note of the name on a scrap of paper while I tapped on the next entry. This time, a longer article appeared, describing the opening of a club for billionaires. The luxury of the rooms made the people lounging in them look unreal, and I felt slightly sick,
thinking of these same men and women attending balls to raise funds for starving nations. How many thousands of people could have been fed by the money squandered on decorations in each of the ballrooms, let alone the amount spent on clothes and jewels for the occasion? And how much of the money raised actually got where it was supposed to go? Aaron Race was listed in a caption under another photograph of him with Dieter. Only this time, she was wearing daffodil yellow silk chiffon. With them, according to the caption, were Lord and Lady Harmigan. The couple looked like an astonishingly ugly elderly father and his exquisite daughter, but they were described as recently married. "I think she used to be some kind of radical artist, but I can't remember her real name," Jilly murmured, tapping on Patricia Harmigan's glowing face. I scrolled through the article to be sure there was no other mention of Race, then tapped on the next item listed. Another magazine, another article, another charity fundraiser. But my neck prickled, because this one was at Castledean Estate. Aaron Race's name appeared as the owner of the venue, but the article focused on one of the guest artists headlining the concert program for the night, a rock star so famous that even I recognized his name, though he'd died about 3 years before. "Didn't Dawood Raphael," Chilly began, "commit suicide?" I said. Harry Solomon's words floated through my mind with chilling emphasis. "Aaron Race is bad news for artists. He ruins their lives, or their careers, or he turns them into something that's the opposite of everything they cared about before they met him." I wanted very badly to tell Jilly about the meeting with the journalist then, but the promise I made stopped me. "Now I remember," Jilly said. "Everyone was calling Dawood Raphael the New Age Dylan because he brought the protest song back, but then he went into leather and chains and his songs got a lot tougher and more violent and people said he was outrageous and he must be on drugs. I'm sure it was him that did a concert with real blood smeared over his face. And then there was the time he used a water gun to squirt red stuff at the audience, and they went crazy because they thought it was blood. A girl got badly hurt in the stampede, and it wasn't long after that he killed himself," I said. "Write his name down." She obeyed, and now the list read, "Angel Blue, Patricia Harmigan," with a question mark beside it, "and Dawood Raphael." The next item was from a serious kind of art magazine and talked about a man called Oliver Spike. He was a writer talking about technique and philosophy and about his underprivileged youth in the UK. I skimmed, looking for a mention of Aaron Race, and found it right at the end of the article, where Oliver Spike called him a close personal friend. Jilly wrote his name down too, then pointed at the clock. "One more," I muttered. The next article was about a poet called Zabra, one name only. There was a picture of her with Aaron Race and Dieter, a small, plain woman with short, greying hair and drab, grey clothes. The article said that she was one of a number of writers to receive a coveted humanitarian award for her cycle of poems on the theme of inhumanity. The prize, the article said, was the initiative of Dieter Race, and the caption under the picture mentioned that Zabra had won several other awards, but this was the first, with a lot of prize money. The journalist added that Zabra had received her prize at a ceremony at Castledean Estate in Remington. "Castledean Estate again," I thought. "Oh, hi," Jilly said, with such false enthusiasm that I knew at once who was behind me. I tapped the exit key and turned to see Harlan Sanderson leaning in the doorway of the computer room in a way that suggested he'd been there for some time. My heart pounded as I tried to remember we had made any reference to my extended senses or to Aaron Race.
"Sorry to hear about your house, Jilly,"
Harlan said to her sincerely, but he smelled ghastly, and any doubts I had about our idea that he was infected with wrongness vanished. My skin crawled at the thought that he wanted to set up a date so that the sickness he carried could infect me. "At least no one was hurt," Jilly said.
"Your grandmother's lucky she had insurance and money."
Harlan's voice was pleasant, but Jilly bridled. "Money can't replace photographs and mementos from a lifetime."
"I guess not,"
Harlan said. He switched his gaze to me, and his smile widened to show his teeth. Like a shark, I thought, seeing the cold wariness behind the warmth in his eyes. It was all I could do not to shudder, thinking of something alien, hungering to infect me.
I forced a smile, but it felt thin and brittle.
"I've been looking for you all day, baby," Helen said.
I tried hard to look pleased and coy and nervous. "I've been around," I said.
"So, let's arrange that date finally," he said.
Then he flashed a mocking look at Jilly.
"If Jilly can spare you."
Before I could answer, the computing teacher came in and shooed us all away, saying he didn't want any students hanging around the computer room. There'd been enough problems besides that. He seemed unusually flustered, and even Harlan's gleaming smile didn't soften him. Then the bell went, and we all had to go back to classes.
"Catch you later,"
Harlan promised, winking at me and vanishing into a stream of students.
"Not if we can help it, baby," Jilly muttered.
28.
We didn't talk about Harlan as we made our way to science. Instead, I said, "Did you notice that all of the people in those articles had stopped working? Patricia Harmigan married, Dowd Raphael suicided, and have you ever heard of Zabra or Angel Blue?"
"So what?" Jilly asked.
"It's just..." I stopped, realizing I could say nothing clear without breaking my promise to Gary Solomon. Jilly looked puzzled. "You think Aaron Race is responsible for those people not working? He might have had something to do with it," I said, a bit defensively.
"I don't see how. I mean, Patricia Harmigan probably stopped because she married a rich old man, and Dowd Raphael's suicide happened at a gig when there were thousands of people watching, and he did it because of something that happened at another concert. And that poet could still be working. I mean, who knows the name of poets except William Blake and Banjo Paterson and Sylvia Plath? And what about that Oliver Spike guy? He's still working. I saw his name in the paper just the other day."
I frowned, realizing she was right. Then I shrugged. "I just have the feeling there's something odd about how Aaron Race hangs around artists all the time." Jilly was giving me a long, measuring look.
"I have the feeling that I'm going to hear that phrase from you a lot. But I guess we lesser mortals have to get used to the fact that you have more resources than the average bunny."
Like Raoul, she thought my extended senses had told me something about Aaron Race, when in fact, except for noticing the way his attention felt like sawtoothed little fish and the way he bent the air differently from Da, my senses were blind to him. At home that night, it was quiet because Da was away. Serenity had gone up early to her room with a headache. Jessie was working in his room and Miranda was out with Ricky. Mum and Luke were both asleep, so I called out to see if Jessie wanted to have some beans on toast for dinner. We had just finished when Luke wailed and Jessie went back up to fetch him.
"I think he might have a bit of a temperature," he said, nuzzling one bright cheek.
"Should we take him to the clinic?"
"I'll give him some baby Panadol. We'll see how he is a bit later. He's hungry, though."
I volunteered to feed him, and I was still spooning mushed vegetable into him when Jessie got a preoccupied look and said he had to go up and write something down.
"Sure," I said, but he'd already gone out.
"That is one possessed brother we have," I told Luke, who fixed me with an adoring look and spat a great gob of mush onto my hand.
"Ugh," I said, laughing.
I felt so safe and peaceful feeding him. It felt as if I was in another world from the one with Aaron Race and Harlan and Dr. Austin. After Luke was finished, I played with him on a mat in the lounge and was interested to see little sparks and flickers in the air around him. We were building a tower of blocks when Neil came in, saying he'd knocked but no one had heard. "Everyone's out or in their bedrooms, and Dad's not here, but you knew that." He smiled and nodded.
"Yeah, I just came to borrow a mic. Mine's on the blink."
"Have you got a gig?"
"Losing the Rope has a gig tomorrow. It's only a little thing, and we've got someone to fill in for you, Da."
He ambled out to the shed, and then came back 15 minutes later with a mic and leads. "Have a coffee," I urged, pointing to a plate of his favourite biscuits that I'd put out. Luke was in his chair, hammering on the wall with his battered rabbit. Neil sat and made faces at him while I made coffee.
"So, who's out and where?" he asked, when I slid the mug to him and sat down opposite.
"Only Miranda doing the Romeo and Juliet thing with Ricky."
"Cynicism at your age could be fatal," Neil said. "So, what's on your mind?"
I asked, "Did you ever meet that big rock star, Dowd Raphael?"
"The Welsh guy that took a high dive. Yeah, I met him a couple of times when he was an up-and-coming.
but he moved into the stratosphere.
Do you know why he killed himself?
Got my knowledge. A girl was crippled because of some crazy stunt he pulled during a show, and he couldn't handle it. He was an idealist, see, and idealists take it pretty hard when they fall short of their own ideals.
I frowned. He doesn't sound as if he was much of an idealist. Wasn't he shooting blood at his audience and smearing it on his face in performances?
Shock tactics. It was political, and somewhere along the way he lost faith in the power of music and lyrics to make an impact. He said people had to be made to see the truth of the pain other people felt, no matter what it took.
I wonder what made him change. Neil shrugged.
The thing about idealists who want to change the world is that they get pretty messed up when the world doesn't show the slightest interest in changing. I prefer your Dawes band of idealism. He never tries to force anyone to do anything. He just quietly does the best he can and never seems to get angry when things don't work out. He gets sad sometimes, I think, but he doesn't savage himself and turn bitter. I never thought about it before, but being around him is, well, you find yourself wanting to live up to him, be like him.
Chuckled richly.
I tell you, you feel a right git if you lose your temper around him.
I know, I laughed. What about the singer called Angel Blue? Have you ever heard of her?
Angel Blue.
Neil ate another biscuit absent-mindedly as he thought.
She's a pop star, isn't she?
What about a writer called Oliver Spike? At that moment, Mum came in, ravishing in blue draperies. Oliver Spike, I knew him once. Hello, Neil. She kissed him and then scooped Luke out of his chair. We both stared at her.
You knew Oliver Spike, the writer? I asked.
His real name is Oliver Spinyek, Mum said, going to the bench and setting out a bowl with Luke on one hip. He was studying literature at the same time as I was doing art. He wanted everyone to call him Spike. He felt it was more serious than Oliver. She laughed gently and tipped muesli into the bowl. Poor Oliver. He was just beginning to win prizes when there was that scandal with an underage girl. It was silly, of course. Oliver was not interested in sex. His writing changed afterwards, and he made a lot of money, but I doubt it would have made him happy. She went to the fridge for soy milk, poured some into the bowl then, and drifted out, leaving Neil and me gazing after her in wonder.
Your mother.
Neil stopped. I looked back at him. What about a poet called Zabra? Have you ever heard of her? Neil began to shake his head. Then he stopped.
Lesbian poet who retired to a squalid mansion in England with about 20 stray cats. Hey, what were the 20 questions? Am I being milked for an assignment?
I decided to tell him the truth. All of those people were connected to Aaron Race, and none of them are the same as when they started out.
You think race had something to do with them changing?
Neil asked, skeptically. I don't like him, I said.
Oh, fair enough. But aside from the small problem of how, why would he want to change people's lives?
Not just people, I said. People who are artists, painters and singers and writers. Neil shrugged.
Okay, so the guy's into celebrities. A lot of rich cats are. But the same question applies. Why would he want to affect the lives of these celebrities?
It was a good question. I don't know, but I just don't like him. I wish he'd leave Dar alone. I sounded sullen and childish to my own ears. Neil gave me a long stare.
Look, Alison, I guess you're afraid that Race is going to hurt or change your Dar in some way, but you know what? McColl is a grown man, and you are...
A kid? I finished wryly. He smiled.
Pretty smart kid, but yeah, a kid. What I'm trying to say is that even if the guy was up to no good, your dad can take care of himself.
That's what... I stopped. Then I said, how do you and the guys feel about this stuff Dar is doing for Aaron Race? I mean, doesn't it bother you even a little? Neil drank some coffee before answering.
I'm fine with your dad doing other gigs, solo and with other bands. The truth is, if he wanted to go solo or get together with a better band, I wouldn't feel anything but sad for myself. Because your dad is something special. You know that, of course, but I mean he's musically special. Me and Titch are just damn competent, and we're lucky to play with him.
You're saying you wouldn't stand in his way?
That's it.
However, your worry is race. Now, Aaron Race is playing his cards close to his chest, but it's clear he has his sights on your dad. Mac knows it. He also knows that he has a vision when he makes music and that Race has a very different vision and that some differences can't be made right.
I began to feel less wound up. Neil went on.
Mac's taken this Remington gig and this last couple Race offered strictly as one-offs to make ends meet. In my opinion, the association with Aaron Race is strictly temporary.
He threw down the last of his coffee and heaved his bulk up, patting me on the shoulder as he lumbered out. Suddenly I was tired, too tired to think any more about Aaron Race or Da or anyone else. I went upstairs. There was a slice of light showing under Jessie's door and the muted tap of typewriter keys, and there was another slice of light under Mum's studio door. I could hear her singing, which meant she was rocking Luke. I showered and went to bed and to sleep without even bothering to check if Serenity was asleep as well or just pretending. Jilly called before school the next morning to tell me that Sari was being moved to Bellevue in Remington later that day. I felt a surge of relief because a bit of me had feared that Dr. Austin would come back from his holiday and stop the whole thing. Alison? Jilly asked in my ear, and I realized I'd forgotten I was talking to her. Sorry, Jilly, I better go or I'll miss the bus. We can talk at school. That's the other reason I rang. I don't know if I'll get there. Those policemen are coming back to see Gran again. Apparently there was an eyewitness to the fire.
Wow. Okay.
We rang off after agreeing that we would meet at Jilly's hotel the next day and go to Raoul's together. I went to school, consoling myself that it was Friday, and the next day I would see the others and we would come up with a strategy about Harlan. I was trying not to think about second period and English, but to my intense relief, there was a test, so Harlan had no chance to speak to me. I completed my paper as fast as I could, then spent recess in the front office, pretending I'd lost something. When the bell went again, I headed for the computer room, figuring I would spend the next period, which was a spare, there. But the computer room was locked, and there was a sign up saying no students were to use the computers until further notice, as there was a virus in the school system. I scowled at the door, knowing that if there was a bug in the system, it would probably be in the library terminals as well. Then I had a brainwave. The editor of the school magazine was Jezebel Astor's older sister, Rihanna, whom I knew a bit. I was pretty sure Jezebel had once told me her sister used her iPhone to create a hotspot for school magazine business, so if there was something amiss with the school system, it ought not to have affected her computer. I knocked at the door, and Rihanna frowned at my request over her glasses, but agreed that I could use her computer for 20 minutes while she went to photocopy something she needed from a book. Once alone, I closed the door and typed in Angel Blue. 3 items appeared, detailing the career of the singer, who turned out to be a soloist with a reputation for changing her band members more often than she changed her underwear. There was nothing to suggest to me that her career had taken a dive or had become suddenly successful. But I came across a paragraph in the last article that said her real name had been Mallory Hart. This made me think of Serenity, wanting to change her name, and on impulse, I typed her real name into the search engine. I was startled to find another whole set of entries, and even a fan site that claimed she was one of the greatest songwriter activists of her generation. None of the articles mentioned her transformation into Angel Blue, and they were all dated before the Angel Blue articles. There was a photograph of her which contrasted strongly with the one I had seen of her with Aaron and Dieter Race. As Mallory Hart, she was younger, plumper, her hair messier, her teeth crooked, but there was something striking and vivid in her expression that was absent from the perfect and bland beauty of Angel Blue, smiling out from the photo with her hand hooked through Aaron Race's elbow. Returning to the Mallory website, I studied the photograph and decided it was her eyes that had changed most of all. Here, they were warm with laughter and intelligence, and kindness sparkled in them. But in the more recent photo, there was indifference. I read the bio and was startled to find that she'd been born in Shale Town. The date of birth told me she'd be about 40 now. I glanced at my watch and saw that I'd almost run out of time.
I decided to use the time remaining to listen to one of Mallory Hart's songs, an option offered by the fan site. There were three possibilities, and I chose the first. It proved to be a ballad about people who lived ordinary lives with heroic courage that would win them no award or recognition. The song was basically saying this was the best kind of courage because it did not admire its reflection in other people's eyes. I liked it very much, but I cut it off to listen to the next song. This was another ballad about an old man mourning his wife, and again there was a sweetness and gentleness to the lyrics that touched me. I wondered suddenly if her music had changed when she became Angel Blue, and made up my mind to visit the big music store in the mall on the weekend. 20 minutes had gone, and it was almost lunchtime, but there was no sign of Rihanna. I typed in Oliver Spike. There were about 60 items listed. I hit on the first and did a quick scan. The article was about writers and implied that, of them all, Oliver was the most highly regarded. I hit on the next entry and skimmed a review of a recent book, which said that his merciless eye and savage pen cut through the facades of his culture to reveal the bones and innards of humanity. I grimaced, thinking it made him sound more like a butcher than a writer. The next item was an article about writers who had longish careers and who had suddenly been lifted to fame. I was struck by one quote in which Oliver Spike said his life had been simpler and perhaps happier before I became very successful because I was blind to the faults of humanity. I actually believed in all sorts of extraordinary naive things, such as that people are intrinsically good and will do good in most cases, or that one must be honourable, or that friendship is worth dying for. Having my eyes opened to what people are really like has been a painful business, but I can't wish to be blind to the truth. I studied the unflattering photograph that accompanied the article. Oliver Spike, with a cigarette drooping from his lips, his eyes like dull brown river stones in pouches of sagging flesh. He looked like a picture of decadence, sitting back in his purple dressing gown and squinting dispiritedly through a grey haze of smoke. Had it been the scandal about the underage girl Mum had mentioned that had opened his eyes to how people really were? I had no doubt the story was false because, while Mum hardly seemed to exist in the real world most of the time, what she did see of it always scoured through pretense or lies. Maybe Aaron Race had set up the scandal. But as Neil asked, why? Unless Race had thought that changing Oliver Spike would make him more successful. And hadn't it? One article all but said his cynical view was the reason for his success. I heard a step in the hallway, and my heart started to hammer, but it was only Rihanna. She put down a pile of papers and went out, saying casually that I could have 10 more minutes. Elated, I hit on the next item and came up with another article in a prestigious magazine. It said Oliver Spike's writing had begun as a miraculous celebration of the real and was raw in its message that humans ought to clean up their act and start realizing that they were part of the world instead of above it. His later work, while more technically accomplished, had become both obscure and darker in its message.
"I'm not sure I can say my work contains a message these days," Oliver Spike had said, "because a message implies meaning, and I don't seem to find much meaning in the world or life."
I shuddered, deciding that I had had enough of Oliver Spike. I typed in Patricia Harmigan and came up with the article I had already read. I typed in Dawood Raphael, and again there was a long list. I hit one at random and skim-read, searching for a mention of Aaron Race. There was nothing, and I went on hitting items and skimming until I came upon an interview in which Dawood Raphael spoke of being asked to perform for a charity benefit at Castledean Estate, saying this had been his entry into the big time. I typed in Castledean Estate and saw that there was the website for it. I logged in and found myself looking at the same picture as I'd seen on Aaron Race's website. The advertising blurb under the picture said that Castledean Estate was an unparalleled venue for corporate and private functions, as well as being a retreat for artists of all kinds. Then there were some details about how many bedrooms and bathrooms and ballrooms and function rooms and tennis courts and pools. I was about to push on the link that would give me more information about the residencies when Rihanna came in again. "Time," she said. I tapped escape, thanked her, and left. I spent lunchtime skulking in an empty classroom. Harlan had to know I was hiding out, but I was determined he would not corner me again until I'd spoken with the others. The second last period of the day was history, but when I got into the room I found Mrs. Barker collecting test papers from another English class. As I helped her to collect them, it occurred to me to ask if she knew anything about